Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We welcome you all to our December calendar. And we want to especially welcome students from Central Wisconsin Christian School. Would they please stand? And thank you all for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Madison West. Would they stand? And thank you all for coming. Your trip was shorter than the others. And we have at least one homeschool student from Ashton. Would that student stand? Oh, Ashton is his name. I'm sorry. Mr. Ashton, thank you for coming. These students are here with our program cleverly entitled Caught with Class. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. They accept the invitation, they're given materials about the case, and they may do some activities involving the particular case. They come to oral argument, they listen to the argument, and after the second case, they meet with a justice of this court, and a different justice is assigned each time. Everyone is invited to join the students and the justice in their discussion during the lunch hour. The discussion involves the procedures for accepting and deciding cases, not the substantive issues involved in the case. So now let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Prosser. You will meet with Justice Prosser after the second case. Seated to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left, Justice Patience Robensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our first case. But before I do that, if anyone would like a summary, a synopsis of the case, would you raise your right hand and the marshal will give you a summary. It's easier to understand the case if you know something about it. All right, we shall proceed. 06-AP-948, Darnell Jackson versus Daniel. Is it Buechler? Buechler?
Good morning.
Mr. Halfinger, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning. May it please the court. Ms. Spitz and I represent Petitioner Darnell Jackson, who comes before this court asking it to reverse the decisions below and to vacate the decision of the Department of Corrections that he incited a riot. And he seeks this relief for two grounds, two reasons. The first reason is the Department of Corrections' treatment of video evidence deprived Mr. Jackson of his right to certiorari review and deprived him of due process. The second reason is that the Department of Corrections deprived Mr. Jackson of an impartial adjudication committee by allowing Lieutenant Zach, an officer who investigated the incident, to serve on the adjustment committee in violation of the department's regulations and due process principles. I will address first the video evidence issues. First, the warden's alteration of the evidence, removing from the certiorari record after Mr. Jackson had filed his petition for certiorari, the video evidence that the adjustment committee indicated that it relied upon is alone sufficient to require this court, or to justify this court, to reverse the decisions below and vacate the Department of Corrections decision. As the Court of Appeals held in Lomac, It's improper for the agency on certiorari not to present the full record, and that there is no plausible justification here for the record to be altered after certiorari was filed.
Counselor, do you dispute the position of your opponent that the two confidential informants, both of whom gave their testimony separate from the other, is sufficient to support the conviction or the finding of guilt?
Well, the evidence of the two confidential informants alone, if there was no other exculpatory evidence, while extremely weak, Justice Rogensack, would under the case law, again, if there was no other evidence, wouldn't be sufficient. But the question here is, in light of the other evidence existed, principally the video evidence, and there is no dispute that, in fact, there was video. The record is replete that there are digital recordings, cameras in the A1 unit where the incident occurred, in the courtyard where the incident occurred.
Counselor, you know, when I read the record, and I looked specifically for it, I couldn't find anything in the record where anyone said that he was shown on any video. The only thing I could find that might be tied to the video were the timing notes in the record, because they go by hours, minutes, and seconds, and I figured that must have come off some kind of a recording device, because nobody's standing there looking at their watch during the middle of a riot. So, you know, I don't know why the video evidence is so important to you.
The video evidence is so important, Justice Rogensack, because it is the fact that no one identifies Mr. Jackson on the video evidence that is itself exculpatory. The testimony reported of the confidential informants, the testimony on which the Adjustment Committee relied, contrary to Mr. Jackson's testimony and that of his witnesses that he had no involvement, was that Mr. Jackson incited the riot because he met with the persons who were involved in the riot in the hallway immediately preceding the incident. The absence of Mr. Jackson in the video evidence is what is, in fact, would be exculpatory. It is the absence of his presence in the evidence that undermines the testimony of the confidential informants, the weak evidence is the only thing that supports the Department of Corrections determination, and would show alone that the evidence is actually insufficient to find that Mr. Jackson incited the riot. And the Adjustment Committee, although it says it was relying on video evidence, never addresses the nature of that evidence, never compares.
Counselor, my recollection of the testimony is that the confidential informant said he was back in the barbershop before the riot started. So if all the committee used the video for was the timing of the riot, you wouldn't expect to see him on the video. I'm having a hard time following your argument.
No, I believe that's incorrect. The testimony of the confidential informants was that Mr. Jackson met in the hallway outside the barbershop with...
Right, but that was before the riot started, because he supposedly told his boys, you know what you need to do, which meant go get the folks that had been hard on another prisoner. But I thought all the testimony was he was back in the barbershop before the riot started, and the timing that I referred to that I thought must have come from a video was when the riot was going on. So you'd never expect to see him there. I mean, it's not inconsistent that he's not there with the confidential informant's testimony.
But certainly, Your Honor, there was no switch that magically turned on that started recordings at 1:40 in the afternoon of November 11th, 2004.
No, but that's when the riot started. That is the timing of the riot. And what I'm saying to you is the testimony is he was not there when the riot started. No one said he was there at that time. He was there prior to the riot. So that's why I'm having trouble figuring out why the video that you wouldn't expect to see him there.
Your Honor, the only reasonable presumption about the video evidence, though, is that The video evidence is on, the video digital recording is ongoing. And so one would expect that if one were investigating an incident and confidential informants suggested that Mr. Jackson incited this riot by meeting with participants in the hallway immediately preceding the riot, that one would review the video evidence to determine whether or not that evidence is consistent with the confidential information informant statements. There is no reason to suspect that one only begins to look at video evidence at 1:40 when the incident begins. When the incident was supposedly have been incited prior to that, one would expect the video evidence to be reviewed before then to determine whether or not there is any support or whether or not that video evidence is in fact inconsistent with the weak confidential informant testimony.
But Counselor, if the word video were not on the report of the Adjustment Committee, it never appeared on there. In fact, the first time it was on there, it was crossed out, and then it was written again in the report that was given to him. And then the warden takes it off after he files this action. I mean, they didn't have to put the video on there. There's no reason to put the video on there given the confidential informant's information. And one of the things that bothers me about this request is, first of all, I don't see any right in any case, and I read most of the rights that prisoners have out of Wolf, U.S. Supreme Court's case, that says that a prisoner in this kind of an action, which is not a criminal action, it is a civil action, has any right to the provision of physical, tangible evidence. So I don't even see where he would get the opportunity under Wolf to have the tape to begin with. But, you know, those video monitors in prison show a lot of things. Now, if his boys were out in the hallway and there was one other person there who wasn't one of his guys, one could reasonably assume that was the, quote, confidential informant.
If I may.
So there's a lot of dangers with what you're asking here.
First, one cannot ignore the fact that the Adjustment Committee's reasons for finding him guilty show that the evidence relied on included the video. Second, the report to the committee, the investigatory report, leaves no question that that report relied extensively on review of the digital recordings. But beyond that, there is also ample case law. Wolf is not the only case that this court should look at. The Seventh Circuit held in 1981 in a decision authored by Judge Fairchild that in order to protect from arbitrary decision-making by adjustment committees in the prison disciplinary context, prisoners are entitled to exculpatory evidence. The reason for that is an extension of the due process analysis in Brady versus Maryland, and the reason is twofold. The first is to ensure that the evidence that is reviewed by the adjudicatory body, here, including that video evidence, all the evidence is included, that there is not an arbitrary or capricious determination based on a selected amount of evidence, the selected testimony, perhaps, of confidential informants, but that all the evidence is reviewed. And the second policy reason, the underlining the due process extension of that right, is the ability of the responding party, here Mr. Jackson, to present his case as best as possible and attempt to refute the evidence that is brought against him. That determination is not only in Chavez, but in Piggy versus Cotton, and in other Seventh Circuit decisions, in the decision of the Third Circuit in Young, and in fact, the state.
So we're not bound by any of those.
You
cases.
Are not bound by any of those.
How but about that, Wolf? What do you say about Wolf? Describe for me what you think the due process rights are that are
Wolf extends the due process and guarantees a fair hearing. What the Seventh Circuit held in
what
Chavez.
What does it say? What are the three things that you get out of due process rights in Wolf?
One of those things is a fair hearing. And what the Seventh Circuit held in Chavez, what no other court has refuted, what the state has no contrary authority for, is that right to a fair hearing includes the due process principle announced in Brady versus Maryland. The right to have the hearing consider, a hearing
Brady
adjudicator
a
consider
action.
All the evidence and have that evidence
criminal,
provided
counselor,
to him.
Counselor, slow down, okay? Was Brady a criminal action or a civil action?
Brady was a criminal action.
Is this action before us a criminal action or a civil action?
This is a civil action where what is at stake is the liberty interest of Mr. Jackson, how long he is going to be stayed in prison. And what matters in deciding the distinction between a criminal case and a civil case is this a liberty interest or is this a property interest or a contract interest? And what is at stake in this case is a liberty interest, and this court should protect that liberty interest just as much as in the criminal context. The distinguishing characteristic that the Supreme Court recognized in Wolf was the fact that the penological need to run the prison system, that there are different considerations in the prison system. But the state makes no argument here that they can't comply with Chavez or that due process principle. Indeed, they can't. Because of necessity, they've had to follow that rule since 1981 when the Seventh Circuit announced it, because any prisoner in Wisconsin who takes his or her case to the federal courts are following that rule. Nowhere.
Also, let me, if I might, interrupt for a minute, and I'll tell you what gives me some concern, and this is in some way a follow-up to what Justice Rogensack's been asking you. As I listen to your argument, and correct me if I'm wrong, as I listen to your argument, it seems to me that you're asking us to make a finding that this videotape is exculpatory. And one of the cases you referred to a few minutes ago is the Piggy case from the Seventh Circuit. And in that case, if I understand correctly what happened, the Seventh Circuit sent the case back to the district court and basically said there should be an in-camera examination of the evidence by the district court to determine whether or not it's exculpatory. Why shouldn't we take a similar approach here? Why shouldn't we say, this ought to go back to the circuit court. The circuit court here could look at the videotape in camera and determine whether or not it's exculpatory.
Justice Crooks, we are not saying more than that. When I say that the decision alone should be reversed and the Department of Corrections vacated, that envisions there's a question about whether or not this goes back before the agency or back before the circuit court. I think I agree with you that the proper place for this to be had and the place that the Seventh Circuit would have this had in the Piggy, I guess it's versus McBride case, is by the circuit court, the trial court. Here the question on certiorari would be whether or not, you know, is this exculpatory evidence? And the Seventh Circuit in Piggy versus McBride held that the state has the burden to show that it's not exculpatory. Justice Crooks, we would be happy with that.
Could I just back up a little bit? The video, I understand absolutely what you're saying about the video. You're saying his absence in the video would be exculpatory because it undermines the credibility of the CIs who said that he had a meeting in the hallway, right?
Yes.
Okay. So starting with that, do we know that videotape of that area even exists, where the meeting supposedly occurred? That's part of what I'm curious about, because I hear reference to a video with these assumptions as to what it does or doesn't have in it. So that's my first question of you. My next question is, if he knew this video, the idea of a video existed, did he ever say, you know, I want to see the video because it won't show me there? Did he ever assert that, you know, back when they would have been able to produce it for him before that hearing? And finally, what's troubling me is I get the idea of exculpatory evidence, but at some point, doesn't someone have to explain why the absence of them there would be exculpatory? When did the department know that his defense was this meeting never occurred? Do you see what I'm saying? Because they wouldn't necessarily know what his defense was. His defense could have been, sure, I talked to those guys, but we were talking about what we were going to have for lunch. Then, if they saw him in the hallway or didn't see him in the hallway, that would be of no consequence. So at what point are they supposed to be mind readers and know what's exculpatory and what isn't? Help me out with those things, please.
Justice Igor, taking your last point first. The state knew at the adjustment committee hearing that Mr. Piggy's position was that he was never in the hall, he never met with those persons. That was the testimony that he submitted, and that's the testimony of the witnesses he submitted. So they knew that.
So before that, though, would they have known to produce that or even look at that? Because the state doesn't have to produce every piece of corroborating evidence. They could produce the CI's testimony, and that's it. They wouldn't have to necessarily produce videotape also.
Well,
right?
Two things about that. I mean, first, the point that I made earlier, which is that if confidential informants suggest that a meeting happened outside in the hallway beforehand, I would expect, and I think it's reasonable to expect, that the video would be reviewed to see whether or not there was proof that that actually occurred. But beyond that, Mr. Jackson was also interviewed, and although the state, the record doesn't reflect it, one would expect that he told his story at that time. Going to your first point about whether the record evidence on the existence of the video, the record evidence reflects that there were cameras on both sides of A unit and that there was video in A unit in the courtyard. That's at A14th and A15, the investigative report. And Mr. Jackson testifies in his testimony and in the papers that he has show that where the barbershop is adjacent to those areas and has windows that overlook the courtyard and is close to the sergeant's desk. There is nothing in the evidence, though, that specifies where exactly the cameras are and what they show. So I can't help you any more on that. And as to the question about did he request this, no, he did not request it at the hearing stage. But at that point, there was no suggestion by the department that this evidence was exculpatory. And beyond that, the Seventh Circuit cases show that when the concern is whether or not all the evidence before the committee was considered, that's not an instance where we have to wait for a request. Where the prisoner's argument is that, you know, if there would have been some other evidence that the committee didn't actually consider, if I would have had that evidence, if they would have given it to me, I could have shown you that I didn't do this. That's a time where, yes, you have to make the request. Otherwise, you don't have a due process right.
Isn't that what happened here, though? That's what I'm working with you on. Isn't that what he's saying? If I had that piece of evidence, I'd be able to show this meeting never occurred. But number one, we don't even know if that area was videotaped or that evidence even exists, I think, based on the record. And number two, he doesn't ask for it. Number three, they don't necessarily, based on the record we have, we don't know that they would have ever even considered that one way or the other. And finally, there's nothing in the record to indicate that evidence was presented. In fact, the video seems to reference the riot that he was found not guilty of.
Well, again, the evidence shows that the Adjustment Committee relied on the video, and the incident report shows that video was reviewed. And again, the important point here is that when the Adjustment Committee has evidence before it, it is obligated under the Due Process Clause to consider all the evidence. And so this is not an instance where we're not talking about evidence that it was not presented. We're talking about the evidence that the committee had.
So do you think that I'm just trying to figure this out. Do you think they really did see the absence of him having a conversation, or conversely, the presence of Mr. Jackson with the two other individuals? Do you think they actually saw that there was or wasn't a conversation?
What I know that the record reflects, Justice Ziegler, is that the Adjustment Committee said that it relied in determining guilt on video evidence. After Mr. Jackson filed for certiorari in August of 2005, the warden, having once reviewed the record, reviewed it again and said, you know what, there's no video substantiating this. Correct the record so that it doesn't reflect substantiating evidence. And Mr. Jackson's entitled to have a court, I believe, you're right, Justice Crooks, a court decide whether or not that evidence shows that he, in fact, didn't commit the act that he was found to have done.
Could I ask you, on page 99 of the appendix,
I am with you, Justice Prosser.
I don't understand that. Could you explain it to me?
I don't understand it either, Your Honor. I've looked at it. I've looked in the record for an explanation of exactly what that is, and there isn't one.
Well, where was the riot?
Excuse
me?
Where
was the riot? Where was the barbershop? Where was... Didn't the defendant come out of the barbershop at some point and look around? I don't understand the schematics of this.
Yes, his testimony was he did come out at one point and look around.
And didn't he even see three named individuals?
I'm sorry?
Didn't he even admitted seeing three named individuals who were key to this?
I don't recall that. What I know is that he was surely said that he did not meet with them as suggested. The record just is not very informative of exactly, you know, that diagram and exactly the incident occurred, I believe, in the courtyard, Your Honor. But the full schematic is, as far as my review of the record is unavailable. Chief Justice, if I may, I would like to just briefly touch on the second issue so as not to foreclose, you know, the opportunity for rebuttal should the state bring it up.
Well, very briefly, because you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, so
I understand.
One long sentence.
And that is that Lieutenant Zank's participation violated Mr. Jackson's due process rights. And his rights under 3003.82. Briefly, you know, we rely on the Guthrie and Piggy versus Cotton cases. And what's important here is that Lieutenant Zank, well, first of all, the Court of Appeals recognized that there's a dupe, that the Seventh Circuit and in fact, this court has recognized that when it comes to involvement in investigation and in prosecution, that those persons can't then sit on the adjudication. But it said that there wasn't anything in the record to support a substantial involvement and that Mr. Jackson didn't make that argument. In fact, he did make that argument in his principal brief in the Court of Appeals at 14 and at page 3 in the reply brief. And what's important is Lieutenant Zank did not have some tangential involvement. She went and she interviewed Mr. Jackson. She went to Mr. Jackson. She not only interviewed him, but she said, "You, sir, don't you want to relinquish your rights to a hearing?" Why did she do that? To make it easier to prosecute him. This type of involvement, Mr. Jackson argues, and I believe that it really cannot be contradicted, and the state does not do so. This type of involvement cannot be countenance to then have that person turn around and sit on the adjudication committee, especially when the state makes no argument that there is any necessity to have her sit as to have someone else sit. And for that reason also, we believe the decisions below should be reversed. I'll save what remaining time I will be allowed for rebuttal.
Thank you, Attorney Helfinger. Abigail Potts, Assistant Attorney General, representing Daniel Buechler and Matthew Frank.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Abigail Potts, and I'm with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the respondent appellees, which is Mr. Buechler and Mr. Frank. The issues in this case are before us in the context of a state certiorari review of a prison disciplinary decision that involved a riot at the New Lisbon Correctional Institution in 2004. There are two issues I would like to address today. First, I want to discuss Jackson's failure to exhaust his administrative remedies as to his Brady violation claim and why that failure should preclude review of that issue by this court. Second, I would like to address the fact that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals extension of the Brady rule to prison disciplinary proceedings is not controlling in this context, and this court should not change that because to do so would violate the principles of flexibility and discretion that are afforded to prison officials by the United States Supreme Court in the Wolf versus McDonald case. Jackson did not exhaust his administrative remedies. It is undisputed that Jackson did not request to see any video evidence before or at his disciplinary hearing. And in fact, Jackson, after his disciplinary hearing, did not make any procedural due process challenge on the basis of non-disclosure of any video evidence. And I think it's important to note that he could have exhausted this issue. I know that Jackson argues in his brief before this court that he could not have exhausted that issue because he didn't have any reason to believe it was exculpatory. But Jackson knew about video evidence from his conduct report, as we've discussed here today. And the conduct report gave a general description of the areas that were covered by the cameras. If Jackson knew he was innocent of this charge, he could have asked to review video evidence. And I'm not saying that request would have been granted, but it would have given the respondents an opportunity to address that issue. As it was, he made no request for any video evidence at any stage of administrative review.
Did he have counsel?
He didn't have counsel, and counsel is not one of the due process rights afforded.
I understand that. Did he have a staff advocate?
He did have a staff advocate.
And what about the warden? Did he have counsel?
The warden?
Yes.
No.
Did he have a staff advocate?
No.
Did it on his own?
He did it on his own.
What about the adjustment committee? The committee that made the decisions here.
What about it?
Did they have counsel?
No, they don't.
Did they view the video?
From the record, as it stands before this court, they did not review the video. And that's one of the issues that, you know, makes this case apparently worthy of review is the fact that there was an error on the initial decision sheet. But from the warden's correction, the record was corrected so as to indicate that it was not properly part of the record on return. And therefore, it is our assumption that it was not part of the evidence relied on.
Does it mean it's exculpatory?
No.
Does it mean it's inculpatory?
I think that's all speculation. I think what the...
Why are you so sure exculpatory is not there, but inculpatory is speculation?
Well, I think either. It would be speculation to guess as to either. The record just does not tell us. Mm-hmm. The record doesn't say what video evidence, if any, was reviewed by the committee. And what the warden's correction, I believe, indicates is that it is immaterial. And I know his statement is such that it is open to interpretation, and it would be nice if it was clearer.
Did he view the video?
That is also not clear from the record. It's unclear from his statement whether he did or not. He is the warden, and just kind of practically speaking, this was a big deal, this riot, and I would presume that he did review video evidence as
you don't
related.
Know.
But I don't know. Yeah.
May I? There is this disciplinary procedure. There is fact finding. There are documents that begin to be accumulated about what goes into the investigation. And some of those documents refer to video. Okay, I mean, it's just indisputable that some of them refer to video. And as I understand it, those documents, as they were accumulated, make their way up to the warden. And the warden looks at the video and then simply says, I don't find anything important there or incriminating there, and I'm going to take it out of the record. So if this is the record, the warden says, that's not part of the record anymore. Wouldn't Mr. Jackson expect the things that were in the record would stay in the record as they go up the chain?
I see your point. And I think where the critical difference in your scenario is to what the record actually shows is that the record does not, in our position, does not indicate that there was ever a video ever viewed in relation to his case or brought up that chain of command. Very likely, the way we read the warden's correction is that when this case was being collected for return, he recognized an error on the initial decision sheet, and a regrettable error, but an error that he has the authority to correct.
But the video made its way to the warden.
That's not clear from the record either. In this case, I mean, there were several other cases he might have reviewed the video on, but we from his comment, we don't know.
Are you suggesting that certain stuff made its way up to the warden and he saw that there was reference to a video and he called for that? It wasn't part of the record?
Possibly. That's assuming that he reviewed the video while making that correction. And if you look at his correction says, I reviewed the conduct report and I cannot substantiate, I find no substantiation that there was a video showing his involvement. And
Let me ask this. If the documents state there is a video, isn't it reasonable for Mr. Jackson to have assumed that that video was going to be part of the record?
I think it would have been reasonable for him to assume that. I think what we're dealing with is a critical...
So then how do you expect him to have demanded that something be included in the record that he thought was part of the record?
Well, he could have, which he did not do. He could have filed an inmate complaint after getting the letter from the warden. And granted, it was after the fact that he had already petitioned the court for a writ of certiorari, but he could have filed a new complaint, which would have been included in the record. And if this court, you know, or if the reviewing court in that case, the circuit court, had determined that there was a problem with that, the court could have looked into it further. But he didn't take any action until he got to the court to assert a right to this evidence. And I think there's a difference between an argument on the sufficiency of the record on return versus an argument for a Brady violation claim. And maybe we are making that distinction, but I think it's clear that the error on the sheet does not, and the correction of the error, does not have the effect, any material effect, on the issues properly before the court, which are, does he have a right to material, potentially exculpatory evidence in a prison disciplinary proceeding, and whether the record on return, as submitted to the circuit court, contains enough evidence to support the finding. So I think there's definitely an issue that this error raised on the sufficiency of the record on return, but that issue was determined by the warden, and that was upheld by the circuit court, and that was not challenged subsequently by Jackson. And that issue is separate from the issues that are properly before this court, you know, on review, which go to the sufficiency of the evidence as it was conveyed to the court.
Counselor, does Mr. Jackson have a right to view the video? Just say we follow Justice Crooks' line of reasoning and send it back to the circuit court, and circuit court says he doesn't show up on this video. Does he have a right to anything more than a statement from the circuit court about what is or is not on the video?
I would say in this case he not only does not have a right to his own viewing of the video, at least under the controlling law in this case, he also doesn't have a viable Brady violation claim. And one thing that I think is important to discuss here today is the fact that his failure to exhaust this issue, both in his failure to raise any request at all at any level for video evidence, goes to his failure to exhaust and a violation of the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act, which should preclude review, and it also goes to his Brady violation claim, because even the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals extension of the Brady rule requires inmates to ask for the evidence and give the institution an opportunity to address that. And in this case, if he had brought that up, they it would have become part of the record all of a sudden, and they would have gotten an opportunity to respond to that. They very likely would not have given it to him because there was not controlling law saying that he had any right to production of it. So I guess to get back to your question more specifically, we see remand in this case as completely unnecessary because he has no viable Brady violation claim. And he doesn't have a properly exhausted sufficiency of the record on return claim. And I think that's a separate issue that was not argued throughout the lower levels.
Now, does he ever have a right to exculpatory evidence? Does he ever have that right? Ever have a Brady right under any circumstances in this prisoner litigation?
Not under the law controlling in this case, and in this scenario. And I think that's a product of the structure of review in this case, and it brings me to a point that I wanted to mention.
So the state's position is prison does not have to show them any documentary evidence or any other evidence, testimony, anything they have that would exculpate him from the grievance, the complaint. Is that right? Is that
that's
the state's
right.
position? Zero. And then what happens when happens when it goes on habeas to the Seventh Circuit?
If this case were to go to habeas on the Seventh Circuit, he still would not have that right because the Seventh Circuit would be applying. Wisconsin, because of the structure of our review, has...
That may be, but what about in the next case where you say there's absolutely no right for any Brady evidence, even when asked for? No right.
You mean at the Seventh Circuit again?
Yeah.
Well, that
scenario... It's going to get reversed.
That's
I mean, if they follow precedent.
Because of the structure of review in Wisconsin for inmate disciplinary, review of inmate disciplinary decisions, that scenario won't happen because unlike the inmates in Piggy and Chavez, Wisconsin has state court review that has to be exhausted before an inmate can bring a federal habeas petition. Once an inmate can get to federal court, I want to make clear, this is an inmate in Jackson's position who has the effect of his disciplinary decision has extended his mandatory release date. An inmate in that position has to exhaust the state court remedy.
Okay, suppose he exhausts it, and he says, give me the tape. It's exculpatory. The warden says,
no.
Right now, strike it from the record.
And this court can change that. It is our position that you should not change that, because to do so would be incredibly difficult to apply and would necessarily violate the...
What's so incredibly difficult?
So most of the difficulties stem from the differences between the criminal context where the Brady rule was designed and is generally applied throughout the rest of the country, and the prison disciplinary process, which has its own unique complexities. One of them you touched on earlier, which is that there is no counsel, there are no attorneys.
I agree with that, and I agree that it has to be flexible, because I agree that you're dealing with a prison situation, which is different than somebody out loose here before a conviction. I agree with that. But what's so difficult in this case about the video? What is so difficult about having reviewed the video, the warden, the committee, he's not there, he is there, he's not there, but it doesn't mean that he didn't do what the confidential informant said he did.
Well, I think
it's so difficult.
There's a distinction to be made, which is that the difficulties I'm talking about are generally difficulties with applying a Brady-type rule in this context. The difficulties in this specific case, I don't know what they would be. It is possible that if he had requested video evidence at his hearing, they would have let him see it.
Hey, the warden didn't even see it.
Well,
they wouldn't let the warden see it, apparently.
The warden, I would think, you know, and this is speculation on my part, did see the video.
You don't know.
But
I just don't know. That's right.
I don't know that. And we can't tell from his correction.
Right.
And it would be nice if we could, but we can't. The fact is this is a state court certiorari review, and our review is very limited. And the fact that Jackson did not exhaust...
What's the review standards in cert?
Well, it's for say, the sufficiency of the evidence, the review is whether or not the committee could reasonably have come to the conclusion that it was more likely than not that he committed the offense.
Okay.
And I think that's another distinction between Wisconsin and inmates who bring similar suits in other states that don't have state court review, because the sufficiency of the evidence standard in federal court is, like the Brady rule in this case, going to be a different standard as applied. There's going to be a much more deferential standard in federal court for sufficiency of the evidence, a more modicum of evidence.
What are the other standards for cert review?
Whether or not they violated the law, whether they kept within their jurisdiction. I think the applicable question in this case for a procedural due process challenge like the Brady claim would be whether or not the committee violated applicable law by not disclosing the video. And I think in this case, they clearly did not violate any controlling law on that issue.
What else?
What else?
On cert.
Well, it depends on the challenge.
That arbitrary and capricious.
Whether they acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner, but part of that standard is, did they violate clearly established law? Did they exceed the confines of their jurisdiction?
Did you find it arbitrary and capricious to report that there was a video twice and then remove it? Doesn't that give you some sense of discomfort or disquiet in these whole proceedings?
I don't like it, and I wish the error hadn't happened. I don't think the error, though, I think what's important is the error does not affect review of the claims that he challenged, and especially the claims that he exhausted properly. And he had the opportunity to exhaust. I mean, the Brady violation claim is what kind of brings in this sufficiency of the record on return issue. And notably, I think Jackson uses the sufficiency of the record on return as a means of kind of circumventing the exhaustion requirements by couching his Brady violation claim more as a matter of court policy and procedure. And they are distinct issues. They are separate issues. And as to his Brady violation claim, he did not exhaust that issue. And the
counsel, this whole exhaustion argument, I don't want to say it befuddles me, but it's better to say it that way than to say that I am befuddled, so it befuddles me.
Well, then you're exhausted.
Or I'm exhausted by being befuddled. That could be, too. You look at the statute regarding exhaustion, 801.027b. It deals with actions and proceedings. Seems to me that it's not so much exhaustion of remedy because this Brady issue, like you just used the word issue, is an issue. It's not an action or a proceeding. And isn't it really more forfeiture that you're arguing or should be arguing rather than exhaustion of remedies?
No, the exhaustion of I mean, this court in the Hensley versus Endicott case, you know, really interpreted the exhaustion requirement fairly broadly as what it applies to prison conditions has been interpreted very broadly. And it is our position that a due process challenge on a hearing, a disciplinary hearing, is well within that definition. And so it does apply. And it specifically mandates exhaustion. And as this court has noted, that is a precondition to suit, and there is no futility exception to that mandate. That is why we really think that the Brady rule issue should not be addressed by this court, because it would undermine the express intent of the legislature as written in the PLRA, and it really does significantly frustrate the goals of the legislation.
Is it your position, is it the state's position, that you have to state every legal claim, every legal argument before that committee in the prison, before you can bring that argument to the court?
Yes, both the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act and the kind of the its applicable administrative, you know, regulations that go along with it require inmates to present their problems through the inmate complaint system, and there's usually a fair amount of leniency in interpreting how an inmate describes a claim. But in this case, Jackson did not make any procedural claim based on non-disclosure of video evidence and made no attempt to assert that video evidence was potentially exculpatory. And I think it's somewhat similar than the Piggy case, which opposing counsel does bring up here, which is, in that case, the video was being used against him, as it was misstated in this case. And the inmate in that case still properly requested to see the video in order to show the committee why it shouldn't support guilt. None of that happened in this case, so we have no record on this issue, and the court really can't address the Brady violation claim, which is, you know, basically just a procedural due process claim defining the rights of inmates in this context. They can't address that claim with any specificity because there's no record on it. We don't even know if there is a video.
You mentioned Piggy, and I'm referring to Piggy 2 here, and for the premise that due process forbids officials who are directly or substantially involved in the events or the investigation from serving on the board hearing charges. That segues me into the issue, the second issue that your opposing counsel had a brief time to comment on. Why aren't there some problems here? You have Lieutenant Zank was the person who did the interview of Mr. Jackson. And Lieutenant Zank sat on the committee. And if I recall correctly, Lieutenant Zank is the one that filled out the form, the report that had the video information crossed out ultimately. It's your position, as I understand it, that interviewing the defendant is not substantial but only tangential, and therefore we could sit as a impartial decision maker. Is that your position?
Our position is that her involvement in this case was not substantial. And I take a little issue with the record and your description of the record. I think from the record, what we see is all the evidence we have of her involvement is what Mr. Jackson alleged. And all he alleged is that she came to him at the Wisconsin Secure Program facility, which is notably not where the investigation team went. That team went to where the riot happened. She went to see him at his new location, and she provided him the notice of major hearing and waiver sheet. And Mr. Jackson tries to frame this as that she was trying to get him to waive his due process rights. And the record does not speak to what she explicitly said to him when she gave him the sheet, but it is protocol to give an inmate a notice of a due process hearing and the option to waive due process requirements. All he alleges is that she came to him with another officer, gave him those documents, and told him that he was involved in this riot, which he disputed. We don't see.
Was she and the other officer, were they the ones to, the only ones to interview Mr. Jackson in this proceeding?
No, and it's unclear from the record on this issue a little bit.
Does the record reflect that anyone else went to speak with him other than the lieutenant and her accompanying officer about this incident?
No, it doesn't.
This record reflects that she and her accompanying officer were the only ones that went to meet with him about this incident.
From my recollection of the record, yeah, I don't
on
believe
a scale,
it more.
One side being tangential and the other side being substantial, which are the two terms we have to deal with under the case law, where does this fall that her interviewing regardless of what was said maybe, but that her interviewing the defendant shouldn't conflict with her ability to be an impartial decision maker. So where is it totally tangential? Is it in the middle? I mean, normally an interviewer would be a bit substantial to me. So where does it follow here?
Well, it depends how you It's my recollection that Mr. Jackson did concede that he was interviewed by other people, but we don't know who. I don't know who they are. But she, you know, from the record, all we know is that she had a very brief interaction with him. So I would say it's much closer to being tangential than it is substantial, especially in the law that is controlling here, which specifies that or forbids someone sitting on the committee to be substantially involved in the incident. I recognize
investigation. That's what the law.
Well, and that's what the Seventh Circuit case law does say. It has kind of broadened that definition. So if the court wishes to go with that, we would still submit to this court that her interaction with him was far less than substantial, and notably she did not partake in the conduct report, which is, you know, where it shows all the other evidence relied on. She didn't deliver the conduct report, and she had a very brief interaction with him on the issues. Even Jackson, he really doesn't allege much more than that, a brief meeting and an exchanging of documents.
Counselor, if we go with the Seventh Circuit
statement, which is a substantial involvement in the investigation, that's contrary to what it says in the DOC rules, which says no person who's had a substantial involvement in an incident. Is that rule then contrary to the rights of the defendant?
Not under the law that's controlling here. And that is something that, you know, may develop to a point where that regulation would need to be changed. But as far as we know, that regulation is what has been applied by these by the courts in the state. So, and that is why this, you know, this issue has been addressed at various stages of review and upheld for mm-hmm. that reason. That it did, they did not violate their own regulations.
Counsel, I have two questions. One relates to the general rule that the state is seeking as a product of this case. And is it my understanding that you are advancing the position that it is Wolf that controls and that any rights of a inmate in Jackson's position would be constricted by the several boundaries put forward in Wolf?
Yes.
And the second relates to the exhaustion issue. As I understand it, the warden filed his unilateral amendment of the committee's report after Jackson had already commenced the petition for certiorari in circuit court. Is there any, in the state's view, is there any implication of an administrative remedy at that time seeking review within the confines of the administrative review process of the warden's unilateral action?
Yes, 2 points on that. One, it's our position that the warden's correction doesn't affect, actually, the issues that he appealed, which are the disclosure of exculpatory material and the sufficiency of the evidence. So we would say that the warden's correction does not materially affect those issues, and he could have exhausted it as early as the conduct report.
But doesn't that leave the procedural issue?
Yes, and he could have brought an inmate complaint. He was copied on the letter from the warden. He could have brought an inmate complaint as to that issue, as to that correction, because what the warden's correction does is it directs the committee to go back, look at the case, make that correction, and it signs off on a new hearing decision sheet, which is then appealed and which a return is compiled for. So he could have. The facts in this case are such that this happened at a pretty late in the game. And so that does limit the time he had to do something. He could have brought a new certiorari action, you know, a new petition for review on that issue, and at least had some sort of opportunity for the department to address that issue. And I guess, unless there's other questions, I would like to conclude.
His mandatory release date has been extended. I gather he's still in prison, so that this is not a moot case. Is that right? What were the other sanctions? And have they all been imposed so that nothing can be done about those?
The sanctions were segregation and adjustment time that actually the sanction wasn't an extended mandatory release date. That was kind of the result from his sanctions. But those are the sanctions that were imposed.
Number two, if I'm reading the right, I'm at appendix 45 of the blue brief, and this is his complaint. And his complaint is that he was denied due process. Keep saying I'm denied due process. My procedural due process were violated because the committee failed to follow their own rules, which was to get all the information. So your view is that his saying denied due process and that the committee failed to give adequate reasons and that they didn't investigate his side of it, that's not good enough. That was not good enough exhaustion. Is that your position?
Correct. That's not good enough exhaustion as to the Brady violation claim. And I think what we can see, what supports that, is the fact that the record is just inefficient to properly address that issue. We don't know if the video exists. We don't know if there are security reasons for non-disclosure of the video. We just don't know it, and that is one of the reasons that there is the exhaustion requirement, is so that these issues get developed.
Since your opponent ran over time, How does the state want this opinion written? You had the chance to write the opinion. My standard question.
We would ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals. And with regards to Jackson's Brady violation claim, we would ask that this court affirm on the basis that he did not exhaust his administrative remedies as to that claim, and so that claim is not properly before the court. And as to the other issues, we just ask for affirmance on those as they were properly addressed by the Court of Appeals.
And if the court decides that there was sufficient exhaustion, how do you want the court to rule on Brady issues?
We ask that the court not adopt the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals extension of the Brady rule. And if this court decides to do that, we would ask that any application would be prospective, which is consistent with the principles in Wolf, and we would ask that any rule, any prospective rule, be limited so as to protect that flexibility and that discretion that is needed by prison officials in order to allow them to conduct hearings in any sort of efficient and manageable way.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Could I ask?
Yes, of course. Justice Prosser.
Counsel, do you have any better understanding of the chart on page 99 than your opposing?
No, I don't.
Okay.
There is no serious exhaustion issue, first and foremost, because of the reasons that Justice Bradley and the Chief Justice have already identified. Section 801.02.7 of the Prison Litigation Reform Act provides that a prisoner cannot commence a civil action until he or she has exhausted his administrative remedies. There is absolutely no dispute that Mr. Jackson availed himself of all the procedures that the DOC allow. He jumped through all their hoops. And then when he went to file for certiorari was when they changed the record. The exhaustion requirement does not require every single argument to have been exactly made, but that the issue has been raised, and as the Chief Justice pointed out in the record, Mr. Jackson contested the procedures that the Adjustment Committee followed. Second, the state, if it was serious about this, would have raised this argument in the Court of Appeals, and it didn't. And what is more, as this court held in Mentic, the exhaustion requirement cannot be mechanically applied. One needs to look at the liberty interest, such as the important liberty interest at stake here, whether or not the agency has an interest in precluding litigation. And as the state would spin this out, it wouldn't prevent further litigation, it would compound it. Because in the state's view, what Mr. Jackson should have been done is gone back and filed more procedural matters in the agency and then filed another writ of certiorari. It's contrary to the statute's terms. It's contrary to the statute's purposes. What's more, it is clear that under Article 7, Section 3, this court's superintending authority, as construed in both Jarrell and in Guthrie, this court has the superintending authority to determine due process standards for administrative agencies. That's what the court held in Guthrie. Even the dissent in Jarrell acknowledged that fact. Finally, it is absolutely astonishing that the state comes to this court and asks it to be the first court in the land to hold contrary to the Seventh Circuit's holding in Chavez and its progeny. No court, no case that we know of or that the state identifies so holds. The state does so based on no concrete showing that the Chavez rule that's been in effect in the state of Wisconsin since 1981 creates any administrative difficulties. And yet the state asked this court to create a conflict of federal law that only the United States Supreme Court could resolve. That is astonishing. This court should not do that. This court should follow the well-reasoned decision of Chavez. Wolf as it says on its terms, provides minimum procedures, including the due process guarantees of a fair hearing, which is what Chavez and its progeny expounds upon. This court should follow it. This court should reverse the decisions below and vacate the Department of Corrections finding that Mr. Jackson incited the riot. If there are no further questions, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Mr. Rackhoff, I believe this is taken as a pro bono case.
It was, Your Honor.
When the court accepted review, we added issues, as you know, for review, and we appreciate that you and your co-counsel here took this case and have ably briefed and argued it, which of course doesn't mean you win or lose, but just ably argued it and presented it. So on behalf of the court, I do want to thank you and thank the firm for doing this, and as always, thank the state's office of Department of Justice.
You're welcome. We're glad to be here, sir.
Its usual able defense and presentation of the state's position. With that, we conclude our hearing in 06-AP-948, Darnell Jackson versus Daniel Butler. The court will take a short recess so the students who are leaving leave, and additional students will enter the courtroom. We are in recess for short.